Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Put yourself in a doctor's role. You have a treatment that you think a patient needs, something key to that patient's very survival. The patient refuses the treatment you've offered. For a patient with the capacity to reason, to articulate why they refuse, this is okay. This is exercising the ethical principle of autonomy, the ability to direct one's own care. But what if that patient has serious mental illness and the reason for the refusal isn't logical? To what lengths would you go to convince this patient to undergo the proposed treatment? You'd try reason. You'd talk to the patient's family if that's a possibility. You'd strategize with other doctors and nurses. But would you go to court? Would you declare the patient lacking in capacity and make the decision for them? These are challenging situations, ones that occur every day in hospitals and on our city streets. Those with serious mental illness in the United States live on average as much as 25 years less than the rest of us. So how far should we go in getting people with serious mental illness to comply with and accept health care, when often it's paranoid delusions caused by their illness that cause them to refuse treatment? My guest today, doctor and writer Lisa Rosenbaum, is a cardiologist in Boston and a national correspondent for the New England Journal of Medicine. In a three-part series of essays in the journal, she explores situations like these in great depth and offers examples of several heroic individuals going well beyond the usual in their care of the seriously mentally ill. It's a provocative, well-researched, and beautifully written series that is free online without a subscription, and it should go well beyond the medical community to informed readers that are interested in medical ethics or mental illness. Writer Lisa Rosenbaum of the New England Journal of Medicine is my guest today on Studio Tulsa Medical Monday. Lisa Rosenbaum, welcome to Medical Monday. You have written a three-part series in successive weeks in the New England Journal of Medicine about our struggle to care for people with serious mental illness. And you do it from multiple perspectives, but I think starting from sort of the front line, as you are a cardiologist in Boston, and one of the stories, and I'll let you tell it, is where you have a patient with serious mental illness who's in desperate need of a cardiac procedure, and you're really having a hard time trying to get him to agree to this, what you see as sort of obviously medically necessary procedure. And you get some tips from his primary care doctor, a doctor by the name of Gail Levine, who you write about. Do you mind telling us that story?
No. First of all, thanks for having me. So, yeah, this is really how it all started for me. Is I was caring for a patient with schizophrenia, whom I describe in the second essay in the series. And he'd had a heart attack and had apparently refused the procedure that we typically offer to patients to open up a blocked artery. And because of that, he had some of the sort of complications that we often see when patients don't get full treatment. And so when I was caring for him, he had developed a complication, some fluid around the heart, that would also require a procedure. And if you don't get that procedure, you can die. And what I described in the essay is that his primary doctor called me right as all of this was happening, and he at that point hadn't refused, but I was worried that he might, and I wasn't sure how I was going to handle it. The medical, legal, ethical issues were all sort of paramount, and I didn't, you know, they are sort of, now I understand them well, having spent 6 months thinking about them, but at the time they weren't very clear. And she said to me, I don't want to misquote her, but the way I quoted her in the essay was something along the lines of, you know, these patients with severe mental illness tend to die 25 years before the rest of the population. And one of the big reasons why is that they refuse care, and physicians allow that to happen. And she didn't say it in an accusatory way. She was trying to sort of help me through it. But that is sort of how I started thinking about all of these issues, the medical care of those with serious mental illness, and then specifically how to handle care refusals. In the end, luckily, he did not refuse, but what she said stayed with me and bothered me.
So you write in the second of the series, which was titled Closing the Mortality Gap, Mental Illness and Medical Care, about this patient, Mr. D. And Dr. Levine, who knows the patient and has some continuity with him, says, you realize that patients with severe mental illness die on average at age 53. And this is one big reason why, which is that when patients refuse, we just say, well, okay, it's their, you know, they're adults and they can consent. And going back to the quote, doctors assume that because he has mental illness, he has no quality of life. You can't just let him refuse. It really struck a chord with me because of, as you said, the ethics and legality of it. Another, I think, interesting anecdote that you relate that paints a vivid picture was given or offered by Jim O'Connell, who's co-founder of the Boston Healthcare for the Homeless program. Can you relate the story, which is actually in the first piece, Liberty versus Need? And you're in that piece, you're addressing really when, if ever, it's appropriate to remand or involuntarily hospitalize someone with mental illness who refuses to go. And one of his patients ultimately winds up, I guess, succeeding and winds up getting her life back together. And you describe her as a board member all dressed up, where Dr. O'Connell met her at a board meeting. And I guess what transpired?
Yeah, so just to be clear before I tell that story, part of the reason I separated the two pieces is because the sort of legal and ethical issues associated with forced treatment when it comes to psychiatric issues versus medical issues are quite different. And the law actually tends to be a little bit more lenient when it comes to medical issues in terms of saying, okay, like if the person's about to die, you should deliver the medical treatment. But even though I think the law is clear, I think in practice it's still pretty murky. And some of that is because the laws aren't consistent between the states, and some of it is because the ethical issues also aren't always aligned with the law, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and it's a really good point that sometimes the law is different than our own understanding of medical ethics. They're not always in synchrony.
Exactly. So I felt like there was this trifecta where you had like the medical acuity, the legal aspects, and then the ethics, and they could all just collide in this very confusing way. But to get back to the Dr. O'Connell story, which is how I think I started the first piece with that, and it was extremely powerful to me. So he runs this program called Boston's Healthcare for the Homeless. He's an amazing man, like Levine. He told me a story from several years ago. There was a woman, so he goes out on a truck, like a van, every single night, and he's done this for 25 years, I think. Some of this I might not have the numbers straight. And they deliver food and socks to Boston's homeless and then also, you know, try to tend to their health needs. And for a long time, this woman was profoundly psychotic and she wouldn't even let them near her. She refused socks and sandwich. And one night they came and apparently she'd caused, I think, such a disruption that the police had come and then they, what we colloquially say, sectioned her to the emergency room because of her psychosis. And at that juncture, that's when the psychiatrists make a determination about whether or not the patient needs to be admitted for inpatient psychiatric treatment. And once again, the state laws differ about the threshold for which that is acceptable. So some say it's only okay if you're a danger to yourself or others. And some say, well, if there's a psychiatric need that is intense enough, then that is legally acceptable. So after that happened, Dr. O'Connell, you know, never saw her. She didn't return to the stoop where she had essentially lived. And then a few years later, he went to a board meeting somewhere sort of outside of Boston, and he ran into her. And as he told me the story, he said she looked fabulous. And he said as much to her. He said, "You look fabulous." And she said to him, "Screw you. You left me out there all that time, and you never intervened to help me." And I was just so taken by that story in terms of how hard it is to gauge who you can help, who will appreciate it later, and who won't. And I think, I mean, the whole intro of that essay, I contrast that story with the story of another homeless man who essentially, you know, lives somewhere else in Boston. And, you know, Boston's known for, maybe it's even colder in Oklahoma, I have no idea, but
no, colder in Boston.
Is it? Okay, so yeah. It's really cold in the winter, and during one particularly harsh winter, Dr. O'Connell, you know, begged this man to come into the shelter as he was getting frostbite. You know, and a lot of these people get frostbite, and they have to have amputations, and it's horrible. And the man said to him something like, you know, "I'd rather be outside in the cold than in the shelter where I can't tell if the voices are mine or someone else's." And, you know, so those two stories, I felt like, just illustrated this impossible conundrum of the challenge of figuring out when it's appropriate to intervene in a more paternalistic way.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Lisa Rosenbaum, who is a cardiologist in Boston and also a national correspondent for the New England Journal of Medicine. And she's just completed a magnificent three-part series in successive weeks in the Medicine and Society column of the New England Journal, something a lot of lay readers don't read, but I would strongly encourage. These are free on their website, and we'll, of course, link to them. These are New Yorker caliber profiles of individuals and wrestling with very serious medical, ethical, legal issues, Lisa, as you've said. And so you contrasted those two stories of the woman who wound up being angry that she wasn't remanded for treatment. And then, you know, Dr. O'Connell, who runs this Healthcare for the Homeless program, who really knows these homeless, mentally ill patients, and basically, even with 25 years of experience going out in a van at night, not really knowing when it's the right time to intervene. I mean, just how confusing that is. Let's look at some numbers. So you write in the first piece, Liberty versus Need, that there's almost 10 million adults, 9.8 million diagnosed with serious mental illness, and this is usually translated as psychosis or schizophrenia or severe bipolar disorder, such that it makes it almost incapacitates the person and makes them unable to hold down a job, for example. Your research showed that, you know, 40% of these folks receive no treatment in any given year. And just to further underscore that, you go on to talk a little bit about the transition, how we've gone from where we used to have state institutions that essentially warehoused folks with mental illness. In the 1950s, we had something like 337 inpatient psychiatric beds per 100,000 in the population. And now, because of deinstitutionalizing folks, there's only 11.7 beds per 100,000. So literally almost a 30-fold reduction in the number of beds across America. So largely as a result, where are these mental – we haven't cured them. In fact, as the population has grown, we probably have more people in aggregate with mental illness. Where are they?
Yeah, I mean, I think the bottom line is they're either homeless or they're in jail. Or if they're lucky, they have a wonderful family who, you know, takes care of them. So, I mean, the huge issue with deinstitutionalization is that there was this sort of promise of community resources to materialize, to sort of offer an alternative, you know, because so much of what is necessary to restore functionality and heal is structure and work and obviously a place to live and all these things that really didn't materialize. And so I think, you know, it started then, and then the question is, why are we still where we are? Why do we keep losing beds? Why haven't we, you know, created more community places to better care for these people? You know, and that's why I really wanted to sort of dissect the sort of ideologies behind the political and sort of resource allocation that has sort of defines where we are right now.
And you go on to write about how the proposed policy remedies, you know, which includes obviously greater investment in community resources and essentially more money to fund either more practitioners, more locations, you know, but you make the point that money cannot fix two key causes of undertreatment. One you say is side effects of antipsychotic medications and I'll let you explain those. What are some of the side effects that make it so hard for people to stay on these medications?
Right. So the older generation drugs, the most dreaded side effects are really tardive dyskinesia, which is that movement disorder that sometimes is irreversible. And most people, you know what that is.
It has sort of stereotypic, I mean, it can involve things like lip smacking or tongue movements, but it can also involve facial tics, things like that, right?
Right. And so there was sort of a lot of excitement about newer generations, sort of what we would call atypical antipsychotics. And the biggest downside of those is they tend to cause obesity and diabetes and metabolic syndrome. And, you know, since also, I mean, I spent the second part of that, you know, series talking about this mortality gap, like clearly, you know, that we're creating a medical disease in a lot of these patients by treating them. So that's obviously not to say we shouldn't be treating them, but I felt like it would be really sort of disingenuous to just sort of say, well, everybody should be taking more of these drugs because the drugs are, you know, not well tolerated by some people. I think, in the end, believe that it's better to be on the drugs than to not be on the drugs because for many, there's really, like, the social sort of deterioration is basically inevitable without some sort of medical treatment, but I don't think it's really fair not to sort of acknowledge that the drugs can be tough to tolerate. I think, you know, my sense from talking to a lot of psychiatrists about this is it's like the same with statins, which I understand the world's for statins as cardiologists, but you know, if you have a patient who has myalgias on Lipitor and you switch him to Crestor, he often feels much better. And I think the same can be true of some of the antipsychotics. You know, you don't tolerate one and you'll tolerate another.
Okay, so just for our listeners, statins are the cholesterol drugs, the very common and somewhat even popular, and myalgias are just muscle aches that many, many patients report getting who take these drugs, and you're recommending essentially substituting one popular statin drug for another, and that seems to solve the problem in many cases?
It often does. Some people have real, true statin intolerance, and they don't tolerate any, but for many, people find relief if they just switch.
Well, you go on to say, besides side effects as being one, you know, very real reason why, and I think you had an estimate of 10 to 18% of people who won't stay on treatment simply because of the really untoward side effects, there's this other problem, which is that if you have mental illness, frequently you don't know or don't believe you have mental illness, and that's a huge problem, and there's a word for that. You want to tell us what that is?
Yeah, it's anosognosia.
Anosognosia.
Right, which is basically a sort of a lack of awareness of one's deficits. And so I think that that 18% statistic is an important one because, well, it's so important to sort of recognize that these drugs have toxicities. If it only explains 18% of the lack of adherence, for lack of a better word, then, you know, we have to think hard about what else is going on. And I think this sort of belief, just I want to take one step back also and say this is really hard to study because if you don't believe you have an illness, you don't identify yourself to researchers who are trying to figure out why you're not taking your medication. So, you know, everything I'm saying has to be sort of interpreted with that caveat. But that said, I think that this, you know, some people, Fuller Torrey, for instance, who's a really prominent psychiatrist, I think argues that about 40 to 50% of people with severe mental illness don't believe that they're sick. And so, I mean, that's exactly why we have to start thinking again. That's why this whole liberty versus need issue comes in, because, you know, if you're at a juncture in your life where you don't believe you're sick, but there's a chance that with treatment you not only will, you know, be able to have a job and normal social life, but also some insight into your disease, is it incumbent upon society to force treatment at that one juncture?
Wow, yes. I want to move into a later part of that first article where you essentially lay out one of the central conflicts, which we've already touched on, which is when it's appropriate, I think, to be arguably, you could use this term, paternalistic or not, when to respect the autonomy of the individual, which, you know, is a paramount norm of medical ethics, right? We respect the autonomy of the patient, except in the instance where the patient lacks decision-making capacity. And you compare two Harvard professors. One is, they're both law professors, although interestingly, Dr. Alan Stone is also a psychiatrist by training. And then, of course, the much more famous Alan Dershowitz. And they sort of had a disagreement about when it's appropriate to command or remand somebody to involuntary hospitalization. Dershowitz arguing more the point of a person would have to be in imminent danger to themselves or others to justify having their civil liberties restrained. But Dr. Stone had sort of a different take on it, although he admits that it's hard to define that. Can you explain a little bit more about that?
Right. So his theory, Dr. Stone's, is the thank you theory of paternalistic intervention. I think I loved, you know, just the title of it, and I also was very taken by the story, this idea of these sort of two very brilliant and esteemed professors who came up with this theory in a Harvard Law School classroom, you know, and arguing. And so Stone's theory is simply, you know, it sort of is analogous if we go back to that first story that we talked about with the woman who says to Dr. O'Connell, screw you for leaving me outside for so many years. It's to catch the screw you people who are going to say to you down the road, how could you not have helped me? And then, so in essence, they will thank you for intervening and they will thank you for your paternalism later on.
So interesting. And so, of course, figuring that out is really the rub. And he goes on to sort of admit that that theory has pretty much been beaten down.
Yeah.
Because why? Because we are so protective of civil liberties, that is, we're so reluctant to trample on the rights of the individual?
Right. So, I mean, that was sort of my essential philosophical question that I just sort of spent months trying to figure out. Like, why? Why are we so against this? What happened? You know, is it, do we have this memory of what life was like in the institutions and that it was so barbaric and torture, and we want to go so far away from that that, you know, we find paternalism so aversive? Is it the one flew? I mean, a lot of people say, well, one flew over the cuckoo's nest, which I don't think I even ended up writing about in the end. But, you know, do our ideas about mental illness and sort of forced treatment come from that? Because there are some really barbaric scenes, you know. But, I mean, to be honest, I hadn't even watched One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest until I wrote this. So it's really hard to know where people's ideas about mental illness are coming from. And so finally, you know, as I tried to unpack this more and more, you know, I getting to this idea of stigma. And this is really, you know, this is my attempt to try to understand what's going on. But, you know, any time you start talking about mental illness with anybody who's involved in sort of addressing mental illness, stigma is like, you know, 1, 2, 3 item on the list of things, sort of things that we need to address and make better. You know, it's this huge problem. And, you know, you talk to parents of children with mental illness, you talk to people with mental illness themselves, like, it's horrible for them to go through life feeling judged, like they don't belong, like people have different expectations of them, et cetera. So there's no question that stigma is this huge problem. But the question becomes, what have we done to address stigma as a society? And as I try to figure out, you know, in 2016, what is it that makes us so anti-paternalism, I started to wonder whether in our efforts to address stigma, we've tried too hard to normalize mental illness. And in doing that, in trying to make it seem like it's not a disease, does it make it much harder to intervene? Because we feel like we should treat the refusals in the same way we would treat a person whose insight was intact. I can't prove that, but that was sort of the ultimate speculation that I made in the essay.
Wow. I want to come back to that. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann, hosting Medical Monday. My guest today, Lisa Rosenbaum, Brigham and Women's cardiologist and national correspondent for the New England Journal of Medicine. She's just written 3 masterful long thought pieces in New England Journal of Medicine, which we will link to on our website under the Medicine and Society column, all about serious mental illness and what you just talked about, stigma. Perhaps trying to destigmatize mental illness, which I will tell you is still a very huge problem, but a very interesting assertion on your part that in doing so, one way that I certainly agree with you is how we use language. And you have a nice paragraph in one of the 3 pieces. I think it's actually back in the first one, Liberty versus Need, where you talk about illness minimization, which I would say is probably akin, if not synonymous, to destigmatization. And you put in quotes, I like that because it's provocative, behavioral health system in quotes. So what is it that we're doing with mental health patients or patients with serious mental illness perhaps in not using words like patient or disease or survivor, but what kind of language are we using? And then, you know, what does that do to the thought process about it?
Right. So again, I can't prove any of this. You know, we can, you know, invoke Chomsky and say language informs thought, et cetera, which is sort of how I think about it. But I think that we are basically exhorted as doctors or even as society not to call people with mental illness a patient, you know, when they present for care. They're a client, consumer, survivor. And survivor, it particularly sort of loaded because it refers to, I think, treatment during the institutionalization. So just sort of the sense that, you know, you weren't treated for your mental illness. You survived the treatment by the psychiatrist treating you. So it sets up this very, I think, antagonistic relationship between psychiatrists who are, you know, obviously trying to heal and offer care, and those in need of care. And you know, how does our language affect our willingness to be paternalistic? I don't know. I wish we could study that. But I think that all of this is very well-meaning, you know, to sort of protect people from harm and previous, you know, we have this memory of previous abuses and also wanting them to feel as empowered as possible to live lives like people who don't have serious mental illness. But I think that the unintended consequence is the suggestion that it's not a disease that needs to be treated like any other disease. And I think that ultimately does a disservice to a lot of the patients who would benefit from treatment that sometimes needs an element of a big nudge.
A big nudge. There it is. Well, yes. So that nudge might be the paternalistic nudge of doing something against the patient's will, but if the patient in the end is going to say, why didn't you help me? Then, of course, helping them is the way to go. This is so interesting. Well, the third piece in the series is called Unlearning Our Helplessness, which talks about coexisting serious mental and medical illness. One of the themes is establishing trust, and you portray Dr. Kelly Irwin, who's a psychiatrist at Massachusetts General Hospital, who has a pretty interesting approach to how she practices. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah, so Kelly Irwin is a psychiatrist, but, you know, the first time I talked to her, I kept saying, wait, you're a psychiatrist? Because she's so sophisticated with her medical and specifically her oncologic knowledge, her cancer knowledge, that it's easy to get confused. And that's because she has helped develop this, what they call a collaborative care model, which really tries to integrate sort of intensive psychiatric care with cancer care. So that when there is a patient, and this is all happening at Massachusetts General Hospital, who gets diagnosed, who has severe mental illness and gets diagnosed with cancer, Dr. Irwin and some of her colleagues there are trying to enroll them in this pilot, and they've enrolled a lot. They had a lot of early success, which basically brings psychiatric care to all of the oncology appointments at the very outset, and has the psychiatrist and oncologist working intensely together with the patient, with social worker, with the patient's family, you know, with the case manager, to sort of usher the patient through care, which you can imagine, you know, if it's hard to get, you know, a patient psychiatric care, imagine how hard it is to get somebody through chemotherapy, which is hard for anybody without serious, you know, without even a serious mental illness. It's you know, there are side effects. There are, you have to come every day. There are transportation challenges. So it's unbelievably hard. But, you know, again, this is sort of more discussed in the second essay, but the patients with severe mental illness, the reason they're dying earlier isn't because they're committing suicide or, you know, accidental death. It's because they're dying of heart disease and cancer.
And often, yeah, tobacco-related illness. So the things that commonly kill us but often go untreated in this population.
Yeah, so tobacco is a huge issue that I didn't get into, and you know, maybe another time I will. A lot of people are working on this with those with serious mental illness because it's a huge issue, both in terms of causing lung cancer or other cancers and heart disease.
Well, Lisa Rosenbaum, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Lisa Rosenbaum is a cardiologist and a national correspondent for the New England Journal of Medicine. Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. If you've missed a recent show, you can listen online anytime on your smartphone, tablet, or computer. Just go to our website, studiotulsa.org. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening.
The University of Tulsa welcomes the Greater Tulsa community to a wide array of athletic events, artistic performances, exhibitions, academic lectures, and symposia held on campus. Our public events are open to all. Requests for accommodation of disabilities may be directed to Dr. Tawny Taylor at 918-631-2315. To ensure availability of an interpreter, 5 to 7 days' notice is needed. 48 hours is recommended for all other accommodations.